This week on Daiwa, we're in Madison County. A woman's death starts rumors of murder.
Welcome to Daiwa, the first Iowa-focused true crime podcast, where there's 99 counties and a murder in every one. These are your hosts, Beth LaValle and Allie Tulin.
Okay, Beth, Madison County this week. Big question, have you seen the bridges of Madison County?
Of course, it is a classic. And have you actually been to the bridges?
Yes and yes. And did you know you can skydive by the bridges?
No. Does that mean...
Not like onto
where do
them.
You land?
There's like a small airport, I think, near Winterset where you do it. I watched a brother do it once.
Are you ever going to go skydiving?
I totally would.
Me too. You want to go together?
Let's do it in Winterset, Iowa.
Perfect.
Okay.
I'll meet you there.
So the bridges of Madison County are actually our fun fact. And every year in October, Madison County has a covered bridge festival with music, a quilt show, a farmer's market, a parade, tours of the covered bridges, and a lot more. And the festival started in 1970 by a group of active and passionate citizens who wanted to honor the covered bridges and share community with anyone who attends. And by the way, Madison County is just southwest of Des Moines and includes some towns like Winterset, Earlham, and St. Charles. And the history of the bridges is kind of interesting, too. They're officially the largest group of covered bridges that exists in one area in the western half of the Mississippi Valley. And they were created in the 19th century because farmers needed a way to get their products to market, which meant pulling horse-drawn wagons to railroad stations. So counties and cities started building roads and bridges, especially in rural areas. And they typically build the bridges with timber, but they quickly realized that the timber deteriorates if they were left exposed. And then they also realized it would be cheaper to cover the bridges rather than replace the timber every time. So at one time, Madison County had 19 covered bridges, but that dropped to 10 covered bridges in 1933. Then 7 covered bridges more recently, and now I believe you can only visit 6 of the remaining covered bridges in the county. But the oldest bridge you can visit is actually from 1870.
So of course, the famous Clint Eastwood movie with Meryl Streep is about these exact covered bridges, based on the book by Robert James Waller, which I haven't read. Have you read?
No.
I wonder if I should.
Book club.
So I have some fun facts about the movie. The Cedar Bridge, where Meryl Streep's character meets Clint Eastwood's character, was destroyed in a fire on September 3rd, 2002. Filming took just 42 days, so Clint Eastwood and Meryl Streep were in Winterset and Adel, Iowa, for just over a month around October 1994. And the Bridges of Madison County, which I forgot about this fact, was also made into a musical and premiered on Broadway in 2014. It won a Tony Award for Best Original Score.
That's super interesting. I did not know that. And I'm wondering how they converted it into a musical.
They must have some pretty good set designers that have bridges.
That and just, like, I don't know. The movie plot with me, I don't know. Some kind of weird.
I don't know, but maybe we should go to that too.
Okay.
We should have a marathon where we skydive first, then read the book, and then go to the musical.
I like it. Okay, since we mentioned Winterset, Iowa, I think we have to bring up John Wayne, who is, of course, a famous Iowan.
Of course. Classic Iowan.
Right? So John Wayne, whose real name is Marion Robert Morrison, was born in Winterset, Iowa in 1907. Apparently, he weighed 13 pounds at birth.
Chunky boy.
Yes. His family moved to California when he was in middle school, though. And after he broke a collarbone, it ended his athletic career and decided he should start acting. So by the end of his career, John Wayne was in at least 74 movies, and some of the most famous being True Grit, Rio Bravo, The Searchers, and El Dorado.
You can go visit John Wayne's birthplace in Winterset, Iowa. And also, I've got to be that guy. John Wayne was a self-identifying white supremacist, so not a good look. He said that in like 1971. So he's not the best human being on the planet. I'm not sure we should be celebrating him, but he He is a part of history and Iowa's history and definitely Hollywood's history. With that, should we move on to the murder for today?
Let's do it. So this murder took place in 1915, and a lot happened in 1915. The first fun fact that I found, I really enjoyed, is that avocados used to be called alligator pears, and apparently the name changed to avocados in 1915.
Incredible.
World War I is raging, and this is the year that the Lusitania sinks. The term jazz was officially born in 1915 in a Chicago newspaper describing the genre of music. And the first stop sign was put up in Detroit, Michigan, but it wasn't red. It was black and white.
And in Winterset, Iowa, Fred Meyer was a 22-year-old farmer who was newly married to his wife, Ethel Meyer, and they both lived with Fred's mother, Ida Meyer, on an acreage. On July 25th, Ethel Meyer was found dead in that home. Both Fred and Ida claimed she committed suicide with a gunshot to the head.
However, soon after, Fred Meyer was charged with the murder of Ethel Meyer, and his mother, Ida Meyer, was indicted on the same charge. Apparently, the Meyer family was one of the oldest families in Madison County and were heirs to a large estate valued at $250,000.
Fred was tried first. Fred told the story of his four-year courtship of Ethel Clayton, her maiden name. He believed his married life was happy. He said, quote, "On the day of my wife's death, I went to the barn to do some chores. I had been away from the house about 20 minutes when my mother called me to the house and said something had happened to Ethel. We went upstairs together and found my wife lying on the floor, wounded. They were the only two people at the residence at the time. He went inside and found Ethel on the floor of the living room. He kept to his story that she ended her life and told him she had done so a few minutes after the fatal shot was fired. Except, half a dozen doctors contradicted that. The bullet entered her skull over the right eye and pierced her brain, which would have caused her to lose the ability to talk."
Another contradictory element of the story is that the Myers' neighbor, Albert Neuber, came over after he heard the shot fired. He said that the revolver was not lying beside Ethel, as Fred had said, when he arrived. Instead, it was on top of a dresser. According to the Des Moines Tribune, Neuber also testified that when he left the Meyer home the day of the shooting, Meyer said to him, quote, "Don't say anything about the pistol." Fred admitted to saying this too. Sam Cook and Cal Smith of Van Meter, who passed the Meyer home about 11 o'clock the day of the shooting, testified that they saw Meyer sitting in his barnyard, holding his head in his hands. Quote, "He seemed in deep trouble," they said, on the stand.
Finally, the last questionable element of this story is that there was a discrepancy between the gun and the bullets. It was a .38 caliber gun, but they found .32 caliber bullets. The defense claimed that, quote, "the splintering of the bullet caused it to appear of small caliber than it really was," according to the Des Moines Register. The gun owner also claimed that he had whittled off about half of the bullet in a .38 caliber cartridge and said that it had still worked well with, quote, "effective penetrating powers." The city marshal said that the bullet wound in Ethel's head could not have been fired by the revolver that was found by her side because it had not been fired for some time, and it was really, really rusty. He claimed that a strong man couldn't pull the trigger, let alone Ethel.
With all of those contradictions, Fred Meyer was convicted of murder and sentenced to 15 years in Fort Madison on December 22, 1915. Motion for a new trial was denied.
Meanwhile, Ida's trial was still scheduled for a later date. She put in a motion to move the trial because she claimed prejudice against the Meyer family was happening all around her. She also said that because her son was convicted, people automatically assumed she would be convicted as well. In the Northwestern Reporter, which contains published appellate court case decisions for states around the Midwest, Ida had claimed that people were spreading rumors because her husband had mysteriously died a few years earlier and was found in a farming field. She said that a fair trial would be impossible with all the rumors that were happening around the town. However, we couldn't find any other articles on Ida's husband or how he died.
At this point, the story is all over the country. With the recent craze in true crime, there were newspaper articles about the potential mother and son murder duo in the Nebraska State Journal, the El Paso Times, the Arizona Republican, and even the LA Times. The story wasn't just the talk of the town, it was the talk of the nation. And back in Madison County, the citizens of the town signed an affidavit saying that they were not prejudiced and would not be biased in Ida's case. That was signed by 487 residents of the county. However, Ida's motion to move the trial was denied. In February of 1916, the trial began. The courtroom was packed. People were standing at the back, and it stayed that crowded for the entire trial. At one point, a witness testified that there's a conflict in evidence. The coroner of Madison said that he tried to pull the trigger of the gun and failed because of the rustiness of the weapon.
Another part of the trial was that the state was trying to prove that Ethel was really shot after breakfast around 8 or 8:30 in the morning, and the body was concealed until about noon because they believed that she was not dead upon the impact of the bullet, and Ida and Fred were hoping that she would die before strangers arrived at the house. Ida had said during the trial that the shooting occurred just after breakfast and then later changed her story and said, along with her son, that it had happened just before noon.
Ida's mother, Wilhelmina Stork, who was over 80 years old at the time, was called on the stand to testify. She said, quote, "I never heard Ida say anything bad about her daughter-in-law. But when her testimony was over, she said, 'I've got a lot more I could tell,' which probably sounds more eerier than it did in the trial. The attorney said that is all they expected of her."
Not much was known about Ethel Meyer herself. She had a case of bad eczema on one of her arms, which at one point newspapers questioned had an impact on her death. However, I'm not sure that that's the case. One of her friends, Mary Youngman, who was a neighbor, saw Ethel the day before her death. She said, quote, "She seemed in very good humor and said her arm was better." Another one of her friends testified that, quote, "Ethel Meyer once remarked that she was tired of living and wished she were dead."
So the obvious part of the story that's missing is the motive. Why would Ida and Fred murder their wife or daughter-in-law? During the trial, there was one question that might point toward it not being the picture-perfect marriage that Fred described. Quote, "Did your wife object to the beer parties?" Fred was asked. Fred responded, "No, she never objected, but one night I came home late and she locked me out." "Did you not on that occasion threaten to blow down the door unless you were admitted?" he was asked. The defense objected, and this new question was ruled out by the court.
On February 15, 1916, a jury of 11 men found Ida Meyer guilty of second-degree murder. She was sentenced to 16 years in the state reformatory at Anamosa. At the time, she was the oldest woman ever convicted on a murder charge in Iowa, according to the Sioux City Journal. When the sentencing was read, she stayed composed and made a statement denying she or Fred had anything to do with Ethel's death.
A motion for a new trial was overruled, and both cases were eventually carried to the Supreme Court. In October of 1917, the Supreme Court reversed the decision in the case against Fred Meyer on the grounds that the court erred in not granting a change of venue. And on the retrial, the Guthrie County Court acquitted Fred Meyer. Ida Meyer's case was still before the Supreme Court, but it also was eventually dropped.
And here's an interesting update we get about the Meyer family after Fred and Ida were released. In 1920, Ida's only daughter and Fred's sister, Wilma, died at the age of 24. A few days before she died, the family had called a Dr. Hunt of DeSoto over, and on the day of her death, they also called Dr. Sumners of Van Meter to the home. Information filed with the county attorney resulted in an order for a coroner's inquest, so they dug Wilma's body back up after her funeral. Those involved were W.W. Cassidy, acting as a coroner, and David Britton, P.G. Rolston, and Ben Day as members of the coroner's jury. Also present was Ida's other son, Carl, and both doctors who called on Wilma before her death. The jury was investigating to see if a crime was committed and caused Wilma's death. They eventually sent her stomach to be examined for signs of poisoning.
This was the third time the Meyer home had experienced a bizarre death. Again, it was Ida's husband died suddenly while working on his farm, Ethel Meyer supposedly committing suicide, and now another young girl was dead at the age of 24.
So that seems pretty suspicious, but eventually we get a confession from Dr. Hunt, the doctor who visited Wilma a few days before she died. Dr. Hunt confessed that Wilma Meyer admitted she was in trouble and Dr. Irwin of Earlham performed an abortion. She had tried to get one in Des Moines, but they were going to charge her $150 for the operation. Contradicting this, Dr. Sumner, who was the doctor called on the day of her death, testified that Wilma had told him that the cause of her trouble was exposure in a shower while she was getting in the stock on the farm. Not really sure what he means by that, but the whole Dr. Hunt story reminds me of our Maud Stone episode in Decatur County.
Oh, for sure.
Check it out, audience.
It's a good one.
There's not really a good ending to Wilma's case, except that no poison was found, and it was believed that she died from the botched abortion.
Eventually, Ida Meyer died in 1944 at the age of 82 years old. She's buried in the Trinity German Lutheran Cemetery in Madison County, with her husband, daughter, and son Carl. Also, we found that in Ida's obit, it said the funeral was attended by a Mr. and Mrs. F.W. Meyer and son Duane of Dallas County. So this kind of led us on the hunt to find out what did happen to Fred Meyer after all of this. And we finally have some exciting news. We think we found him.
Yay.
So we believe that Fred Meyer went on to live a pretty normal life in Dallas County. We found a Frederick W. Meyer who went by Pete, who was born in 1893 and died in 1966, which would have made him 23 at the time he testified for Ethel's murder, which matches the quote we found in the paper. Also, both were named Frederick W. Meyer. Anyway, Fred, or Pete, married Dorothy Meyer and went on to have two sons. One of the sons' name was Duane. We did find that Fred died in 1966 after being involved in a car crash where he collided head-on with a soft drink truck south of the town of Minburn. And that's it.
What a crazy story.
Crazy.
If anyone knows anything about this, please let us know. But I've got questions for Taps. You ready to call him?
Let's give him a call. Hey, Taps. Thanks for joining.
Hello.
We are doing Madison County. Have you ever been?
Many times.
What are your fun facts?
Well, of course, the infamous bridges of Madison County. Madison County, Iowa has the only covered bridges. And then John Wayne was born there in Madison County. It is actually a very scenic county just west of Des Moines. A lot of cool towns. And they actually do a lot of skydiving in one of the towns.
Is it maybe your favorite county?
Well, I don't know about that, but it's a nice county.
Have you ever been skydiving?
Yes, I have.
Give me your scale of 1 to 10 rating, 10 being the best.
Oh, it's about a 9.75.
Oh, man, that's high.
Yeah, no, it's fun.
I think we sign up. Daiwa team bonding.
Oh, my God.
Wait, you're a pilot. We've discussed this.
Yes.
Do you take people skydiving?
No.
No.
No, but I've just...
Need, like, a license to do that, I suppose?
I just skydived. Because I did static line jumps, I had to go to a class as opposed to the... bonded jumps where you get strapped onto somebody else and jump out.
Gotcha. Crazy. Okay, moving on. So what would someone do with the discrepancy between the gun and the bullets today? So we talked about how the caliber was maybe different or someone had altered those bullets in some way.
Yeah, I mean, forensically, it would be very easy to prove what caliber of bullet it was. And the ability to shave or disfigure the bullet in some way would not really affect it. You would be able to tell with microscopic imagery and things like that what caliber of bullet it was.
Well, we also talked about, you know, the trial being moved. What makes a judge move a trial to a different county?
So change of venue is done when the judge believes it's too prejudicial to have a trial in that county. In other words, they cannot find a jury of their peers that would be impartial. There's been too much media or some other kind of external fact that would cause a trial to be tainted. Judges do not like to do that because it's very expensive. And you can actually move the trial to a different place, a different county, or you can have a jury from a different county brought into your county to try the case to. So the jury pool would be picked in some other county and brought into the county where the trial is held. But judges are very reluctant to do change of venue because it's very, very expensive.
What do you do if it's like so popular that everyone knows about it? I'm thinking of like the Manson case where literally everyone in the country knew.
So part of the pretrial preparations for those kinds of trials are the judge querying both sides to see if they believe they can get an impartial jury pool. And in many of those cases, like the Manson trials in a large metropolitan area. So you would have a better ability of just bringing in a very, very large jury pool and finding people that were either didn't know about it or their knowledge of it was slight enough or unaffected enough that you could make them potential jurors.
Are there any tactics that are used to see if people lie about that?
Yeah, that's what voir dire is. That's when the lawyers voir dire the jury. That's what they're attempting to do, is find out exactly from the jurors how tainted they are, or do they have some kind of prejudicial relationship to the trial or the charge of the case that they can't be used.
All right. So all of the evidence during this trial was circumstantial. How often is someone found guilty with just circumstantial evidence?
It happens. And I don't even want to say it's rare, but it's obviously more difficult for the prosecutor to prove a case with circumstantial only evidence. But in some cases, the circumstantial evidence is so overwhelming that it causes the jury to find the person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I think of one particular case that I was associated with just on the fringes, where a woman was killed, body was never found. And one of the circumstantial pieces of evidence is they took the mattress in which the woman was killed, made a comparison of how much blood was inside the mattress and left around the crime scene, and determined that no human being could lose that much blood and not die. So that was kind of an interesting forensic way to prove a circumstantial fact, that this person could not have lived losing that much blood. So there are those kinds of cases out there.
That's interesting. So say, very hypothetically, that Fred killed his wife and Ida had nothing to do with it, but she just went along with it. What would Ida have to do differently in order to be found innocent?
The biggest thing would be for her to have an independent attorney that would represent her and provide facts to the fact finder, whether that be a judge or a jury, that says, you know, she couldn't have possibly been associated with it because of the following facts. So, I mean, that's why you have a lawyer. You have somebody to advocate for those kinds of things.
So it also seems like the media kind of wanted this one to be a mother-son murder. Have you ever been a part of a case where you think that the media impacted the conviction?
Well, that goes back to your change of venue question. I mean, yes, the media can be overwhelming in cases where it's prejudicial. And there are very strict rules for both the prosecutor and the defense lawyer about how much they can talk about trial before the trial or outside of the courtroom. Many times judges will censure the people involved in the case so they can't make any public statements for a certain time up to trial or during the trial. So that's the judge's job, is to make sure that we can have a constitutionally favored trial with no prejudice in it. And so the judges will work hard in trying to keep those outside influences away from the trial itself.
Would you change your name if you were Fred/Pete?
I don't know. That's interesting. But in 1900, Fred or Pete probably was a pretty A-OK name.
What? No, we're saying if you got accused of murder and then you got out of jail.
No, I can't imagine. And I can't imagine doing that four counties over or whatever. I mean, to me, if you're going to get out of the limelight from a case, you'd move to like Anchorage or someplace.
Yeah, but do you think that was possible in...
Well, it's definitely possible, but I just don't know if the person wanted to. That was the issue. But can you imagine going four counties over and not being known by somebody?
I feel like I could.
I don't know. I guess that's a good point, but I've never tried it.
I mean, in Manhattan, you might be able to do it, but in rural Iowa, it would be tough.
Okay, and what do you think of Fred's car crash at the end?
I mean, is it happenstance? I don't know. Or is it related at all? The older I get, the more I try not to figure out all these spurious things that happen to people, because sometimes stuff happens.
Have we asked you before if you believe in karma?
I I think you create your own karma by your actions and behavior.
Isn't that a yes then?
Well, I mean, it's not karma in a metaphysical sense. It's karma in I've acted a certain way, so this is what's going to happen.
So a consequences.
Yes. You're
a big fan of consequences.
Pretty black and white about that stuff.
Do you think this family just had like really unfortunate circumstances happen to them? Or were you also like a little more intrigued to learn more after finding out like the daughter died young, the father died young? And then
in today's society, that would have been looked at a lot because it is kind of bizarre. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, at the turn of the 19th to the 20th century, I don't know if there was that much attention paid to all of it.
There was definitely some attention paid, according to some of these articles I read. But I see what you mean. Yeah.
I mean, look at the sophistication of the investigators, people like that. It just wouldn't, in rural Iowa at that time, just wouldn't have been that substantial.
Yeah.
And most of the forensics we talk about today, I mean, none of it was available back then. You know, there could be media speculation, but it would have been just that, speculation.
Are you getting sick of all of our historical cases because you can't really comment on how they would get solved today?
Well, I mean, I don't know how those people did it. It would have been difficult because I would instantly say, well, you know, let's do blood spatter. Let's do some kind of testing or protein testing or things like that. None of that was available to them. I mean, we're talking about a time when fingerprints were just being developed. So, yeah, it would have been difficult.
Any final thoughts?
No, but I encourage people to visit Madison County. It's really nice.
Those are like the happiest final thoughts we've had.
Oh my gosh. What an optimistic ending.
All right. Well, thanks for joining. We'll see you next time.
Good night.
Oh, hello there. As a marketer, I hate promotions like this.
Same and same.
But I love content.
Me too.
So if you like our content, give us a like, follow, share, subscribe, note, fax, literally anything you think would help us continue making Daiwa a success.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.